Welcome to the Drill Down. We've got business stories behind stocks and a move. I'm Corey Johnson. On October 6th, we've got episode number 111. Yes, 111. Well, just ahead, the business model behind Ghost Kitchens with Noodles & Company. Yes, Ghost Kitchens and Noodles & Company are both things. We'll talk about that. And the latest in a litany of shipping woes. Do you now need to worry about power outages in China? And the mighty struggles of green energy supplier Flotek. We've got John Gibson coming back to talk to us about why his company is struggling so mightily and why he thinks it's still going to do well. But first, it's sponsor time.
The Drill Down is brought to you by Era. Never miss another critical event or insight ever. With Era, customize your company watch lists and track key events, mentions, filings, and more, all within an easy-to-use, customizable interface. That's Era, AIERA.com.
And we hope you listen to the Drill Down every day, as so many of our listeners do. That's easier. Use your smart speaker. Just turn to that smart speaker and ask it to play the latest Drill Down podcast.
And the Drill Down is brought to you by Brain Trust, a global talent network that matches highly skilled technical freelancers with the world's most reputable brands. Brain Trust has helped clients like Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, Porsche, Under Armour, and more build agile tech teams fast at a fraction of the cost. Visit braintrust.com, that's BRAINTRUST.com, to learn more.
I'm Corey Johnson. Welcome to the Drill Down. We do explain the business stories behind a handful of stocks on the move. We also have the three most important developments in the world of business right now with executive producer Isaac Webster. Isaac?
Corey, let's start with Facebook. Facebook's been in the news for a while now. We haven't really touched this story. But today, Facebook has slowed the rollout of new products to examine their possible impact on users. Now, this is according to the Wall Street Journal. The paper says Facebook is putting a hold on some work because of recent media reports and congressional hearings related to the exposure of internal documents showing some harmful repercussions from its platforms. Now, reportedly, more than a dozen people are involved in conducting, quote, reputational reviews to examine how Facebook may be criticized and to ensure products don't adversely impact children.
Bias alert, we own some Facebook shares and have for quite a while, although I've sold some lately for unrelated reasons. But I have kept track of the performance of Facebook after Mark Zuckerberg testifies before Congress, and it almost universally goes up over time. The real question here is do the horrible headlines and deservedly horrible headlines coming out of this congressional testimony make one bit of difference? Did anyone stop using Facebook or WhatsApp or Instagram because of these headlines? And is maybe slowing product rollouts might have an effect? Maybe this is just a nod to the government to make it look like the testimony is having an effect on the business. But thus far, it doesn't look like it slowed them down one bit.
Yeah, I think the only way that they get slowed down was when they had that outage for around 6 hours. Number two, let's get to General Motors. General Motors set one of its most ambitious financial targets in years, telling investors it aims to more than double revenue by 2030. The automaker also says it plans to take the lead in electric vehicle sales in the U.S., but it did stop short of providing a timetable on that goal. And finally, let's go on to Amazon-owned Twitch. The video game streaming platform has suffered a data breach. The Twitch information was leaked on the online chat forum 4chan. The 4chan user who allegedly posted the Twitch data said they did so to hurt Twitch's business. The person claimed to have access to information including Twitch source code, internal security tools, and creator payouts. The user labeled the data dump as, quote, part one, suggesting there might be more to come.
I think we should get that guy working on a podcast. That's a good forward tease. To forward road. This is just part one.
That's
more
a good tease.
Coming later.
But what's Stay not tuned. Fun is a data breach like that.
Stay tuned for one more hack.
Corey, what stocks are you drilling down on today?
Let's look at Acuity Brands. Do you know this company?
No, I don't. I've never heard of this. Acuity Brands trades under AYI. Shares rose 11% today, and they've gained 78% in a year. Tell me about Acuity Brands.
So it's a big company. They are, you know, it's $7 billion market cap. They do lighting and lighting supplies and thermostats and building management systems, they call them. Interesting company. They reported earnings today. They're pretty good. Stock was up, as you mentioned, a good amount today. But, you know, once again, I think the big takeaway was what's going on with their supply chain. they are talking about how, because it's such a big company and they've got production in the U.S. and Canada, in Asia, and in Mexico, that they really can move production around to create things into places where they have raw components to do so, and that that might give them some opportunities that they wouldn't have otherwise. And so when asked on the conference call about kind of supply chain problems, talking about freight issues as well, with someone named Karen who was on the call, whatever, this notion that they can move production to where it needs to be has helped them with supply chain problems, but hasn't solved all those problems entirely. Here is the CEO, Neil Ash.
At the moment, our key constraint is access to containers, and which is why Karen brought up freight. I think everybody's dealing with that. As she indicated, we've obviously planned in advance for that, and so we've locked in both availability and price for certain periods. And now we're accelerating some of that as we look out. Let's add China power issues to the 768 other ways that the supply chain is being impacted by these global challenges, and we'll adapt to that the same way we're adapting to all the other challenges.
So yeah, supply chain issues, including China power, it's just one thing after another. These things don't look like they're lighting up here as we are into the fourth quarter. Lighting up. Pun not intended. Lightening up, I said, Isaac.
Good. Very good. Thank you for that clarification. Corey, what is your next drill down?
Let's look at Takeda.
Takeda Pharmaceutical trades under TAK. Shares fell 10% today, and they've dropped 17% over the past 12 months. So what's going on with Takeda?
So that big drop today was about a problem they had with a phase 2 study that we had every reason to think was going well. The drug that they were testing is called TAK-994, and it is to fight narcolepsy, which I know some of you listen to this show probably nod off when you hear my voice. Don't do that. Wake up. But narcolepsy is a serious problem. These guys thought they had a drug that looked like the FDA had actually kind of approved a pathway for them to run their studies and get the drug quickly approved. And yet in these phase 2 studies, they ran into some safety problems. It didn't say what it is, but the Japanese company came out and instantly stopped the study. They said as a precautionary measure, they suspended dosing of new patients and existing patients in the study, and they stopped the study entirely early, but it's not over for this drug. And they're saying that they will get a, quote, timely interpretation of the risk-benefit profile of TAK-994 and figure out what's next. So we don't know if they're going to actually look at the data that they've gotten and see what's up and if they can understand the efficacy in addition to the problems with the safety. But they're still kind of charging ahead with plans to possibly continue developing this drug. It's kind of a mystery. And I think because of that mystery, you saw the stock sell off. And I think part of that mystery is the company's own fault. If you go back to July 30, the last time the company talked about this drug, Andy Plump, who's the president of research and development at Takeda, said that that they were in this accelerated program with the FDA. It wasn't for accelerated approval, but because the pathways of the product approval were laid out by the FDA, they thought they could be in a conversation with the FDA and get there faster. That kind of confidence was not warranted, and I think that that's why you saw Takeda and the market surprised by today's development. Here's what Andy Plump had to say back in July.
Our base case for TAK-994 and narcolepsy type 1 is not an FDA quote-unquote accelerated approval. Our base case is approval based on accepted endpoint for registration. So the timeline that we're putting forward actually is highly accelerated, but it's not dependent on an accelerated approval by FDA. Now, with the breakthrough therapy designation, we'll have a chance to sit very closely with FDA and discuss what exactly will be required. What's the length of the study? What are the endpoints? Whether or not there are comparators? This is a real privileged opportunity for us. Even with that opportunity, people think that the data are so profound that we can do this in an accelerated fashion. But having that designation will certainly enable that path.
Or not. Obviously what we're seeing today is that the safety problems trump everything else, and they should. But we'll see what happens with the FDA close relationship now that the drug was deemed and the trial was deemed to be unsafe.
Corey, Corey, what's your next drill down?
Let's look at Noodles & Company. Do you know Noodles & Company?
I know of Noodles & Company, but eaten there. Yeah. I've seen the signage places.
You have? I had not until I started looking at the stock this week.
I feel like they're in airports, but maybe I'm wrong on that. Noodles & Company trades under NDLS. Shares rose over 7% today, and they've gained 77% in a year.
Well, it's an interesting restaurant company. Trades at an extraordinary valuation. And yes, they sell, you want your carbs, you want to get the Noodles & Company. Although, to be fair, they have zucchini and cauliflower noodles as well. Yes, you can get your cauliflower gnocchi there, which is hard to do. Nonetheless, Noodles & Company, interesting restaurant business, growing at a kind of nice clip, very richly valued by the market. But what I thought was really interesting is they just announced they've opened up, the recently announced, a second ghost kitchen. Do you know about this ghost kitchen business?
I know of ghost kitchens. I didn't know that Noodles & Company was using this.
Well, they're just experimenting with it, but they really like it. They opened one in Chicago, and then they just announced they opened one near here, Silicon Valley, here in San Jose, California. Some would say that's the heart of Silicon Valley. I don't know if there is a heart in Silicon Valley.
There's no heart. No.
And no soul.
No.
And yet, here I am. Noodles & Company's ghost kitchen business is meant to sort of take advantage of the way people get food these days, getting food delivered. Mm-hmm. And where the restaurant experience happens at your front door, not in a restaurant. And it really changes the way the whole business works. It changes the economics quite a bit. But it also changes the kitchen itself. The size of the kitchen can be a lot smaller. The kitchen can be optimized for creating stuff to go into a package and get out the front door instead of to look good in a menu or to be arrive at a table piping hot or whatever the things that matter inside of a restaurant. Something different for this company. And the CEO, when asked about an investor conference, we had to go all the way back to May to hear some comments, May 19, when Dave Boninghausen, the CEO, talked about the difficulties in the ghost kitchen business, but really talked about why they loved ghost kitchens and why it might create a different kind of opportunity for growth for Noodle & Company. Here's Dave Boninghausen.
What we love about the ghost kitchens, aside from the speed, the flexibility, from a cost perspective, is we are learning a lot about how efficient can we be. Our typical kitchen right now, Andrew, is 850 square feet. The box that we use in Chicago is 200. Now, there's shared space, so it's not exactly a one-for-one type of look. It's not that. However, we are identifying ways to make that next kitchen of the future even be more efficient. So we feel the ghost kitchens will get a ton of learnings on how to be more efficient with our marketing spend, as well as our operations, our kitchen equipment, get into markets that we wouldn't otherwise access in a low cost and efficient manner. But we do want to take a little bit of a wait and see to see what is the ultimate future. Now, what's exciting about our brand is if you think further down the line in terms of virtual brands, we have every ingredient you'd want. You could have an Asian virtual brand, you could have mac and cheese, you could have vegetarian. We hit all of those metrics. But first and foremost, we want to see what are the operation efficiencies we can get? How do we execute these at the highest level possible?
So I think it's fascinating because it kind of changes the growth map for a company who's, you know, importantly, their digital sales were probably 80% higher than their in-restaurant sales in the most recent two quarters. So digital sales really important for this business. Ghost kitchens can make that a lot more effective and profitable for Noodles & Company, presumably every other kind of business that's delivering food. All right, coming up next, we are going to revisit with the CEO of Flowtech, John Gibson, one of our favorite guests, an early guest of this show, and a guest who's seen his stock absolutely collapse despite kind of putting up steady results. We're going to talk to Flowtech's John Gibson about their product offerings and the future of this interesting green energy company. But first,
The Drill Down is brought to you by Brain Trust, a global talent network that matches highly skilled technical freelancers with the world's most reputable brands. Brain Trust has helped clients like Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, Porsche, Under Armour, and more build agile tech teams fast at a fraction of the cost. Visit braintrust.com, that's BRAINTRUST.com, to learn more.
We are joined right now by Flowtech CEO, John Gibson. John, we probably wouldn't have a company of your size on it since we had your company on a few months ago when it was a bigger size. I note you were just talking about being smart enough to have a glass of water to sip as we do the interview. You might want something stiffer because for two reasons. Your stock is trading is down a lot again today, but you've been buying stock. Not only talking about stock, I talk about business. But it is curious to me that you are in there personally buying shares of the company in the most recent financial filings. And so the pain of the stock falling even 4% today or 8% today is felt by you. How does it feel?
It feels terrible, to be honest. I think you want a CEO to feel the same pain as the shareholders, Corey. So I'm feeling the pain, but caught a bit in being small. As you point out, we are a nano company in terms of our size. And as a consequence, I think there are a few people that are in our stock that are also looking at tax losses for this year. Maybe they were in major investments where they have made quite a lot, and so they're stepping out. We've got one or two that I'm aware of that are pondering whether they want to be in the fossil fuel side. But in terms of the story and our execution, I think we're getting better and better. And the green story is resonating. We're probably 6 months away from the decisions at the wellhead equaling the philosophy in the C-suite. And so I think we're on the right track. We have the right vision and strategy. It's sort of getting through the bumps of people restacking portfolios and finding the right people that are committed to fossil fuels and the road ahead.
Yeah, and you know, this is a $25 stock 5 or 6 years ago. You weren't at the company. The company's a very different company then. It's a $1.10 as we talk at this minute. A shocking development. Let's talk about the business. I do want to get to the taxes, not the tax losses that the investors are taking, but I want to talk about the kind of net operating losses that you guys are carrying as well. But first, let's just talk about the business. What is Flotek today? What are the most important products that you sell, and how do you categorize those?
Well, we've probably changed even since you and I talked not so long ago. We were a chemistry company that had environmentally friendly fluids. Today, we're really an ESG company that's selling chemistry for the hydrocarbon industry that allows them to meet their sustainability goals and allows them to be far greener. So if you can imagine what we sell fundamentally is surfactants, which are based on terpene, which come from oranges or from pine trees. So we've got dilaminine or terpenes. Those are biodegradable, non-toxic, and they replace things like xylene and others that have carcinogenic effects, et cetera. And so,
what is it used for at the wellhead?
It improves production performance. And so you can see an uplift in performance anywhere from 5 to 25%, depending upon the mineralogy of the reservoir and the behavior and fluids in the reservoirs.
And what is that? I sort of keep interrupting you because your voice sounds so much better than mine. When do you flow it? Like, when does it happen in the course of working a well and trying to get the oil and gas out of that well?
So you treat the reservoir during stimulation in order to change the coating on the grains so that a particular phase of the fluid flows better than others. So you're trying to enable the flow of hydrocarbons and disable the flow of water. And so we have the ability to sort of preferentially, I would almost call it first order refining in the reservoir. You're deciding which phases and which products you want to produce, and we can and augment or enhance those for you, whether it be the oil or the gas or the water in a well. If you're doing water injection, you want the water to flow more easily, so we can do that as well. So these surfactants are pumped in during the completion job, which is just before you put the well on for production. And it's also used later to improve production after they've been producing for a while.
So I'm going to try to paraphrase that. You drill a hole in the ground with a bit and you drill deeper and deeper until you get to the places in the ground where you think the oil is. It might go down, it might go sideways, probably does both these days, which is to say your conventional well goes straight down and a lateral well is an unconventional well, although increasingly that is the convention. Then at that point, then you case it. So you put steel down essentially to hold the portions of that well together. And then you start to essentially use surfactants to grease the skids, if you will, to try to make it do the things that you want to do, whether it's pump water in to open up the porosity of the well and force the oil up, or to pull the oil up because it's ready to come?
Very close. I mean, the reason we put steel in the ground in a lot of ways is to be able to inject cement behind the steel in order to get zonal isolation. You don't want any of the fluid to flow behind the pipe in the hole, up the well, and into the aquifers. And so we place the steel inside of the hole and then push cement down the steel and behind the pipe in order for it to get a complete seal between the bottom of the hole and the aquifers or other formations near the surface so that we can prevent any contamination of those aquifers. Now, even with that, there can be leaks behind pipe that move channel and let fluids from the bottom go up. That's why we're so excited about having green chemistry and green surfactants and solvents to use in the industry, because if you do accidentally have a leak, you want something that has no impact. And so we're working really hard to provide those biodegradable non-toxic chemicals. So even if there is some issue, your liability or the impact of it will be minimized.
So obviously that's very much in the news today with the leak in Southern California offshore. You know, I listened to some of the conference calls and some of the events that this company had been leading up to. New management at a company, not unlike yours. They've been there for a few years, fixing a lot of problems over the years, not unlike yours. And then they have this just, you know, if in fact, and it's starting to look like some anchor from, you know, we have this huge global catastrophe of COVID. It leads to this really bizarre effect, screwing up the world's sort of shipping process, where you have the result of many, many more ships offshore the port of Long Beach, which means it looks like some knucklehead, one of those many ships was in a place where they normally aren't, dropped an anchor where they shouldn't have, and dragged it until they ripped a pipeline open. You know, the environmental risks posed by having, you know, by this is our fuel of choice in our global society. Environmental risks are being borne out and visible right now off the shores of Orange County.
Well, so I try to be succinct on this, Corey, but you bring up a lot of good points. It sounds like there were in over 100 foot of water. And so I don't know how much time you've spent on ships or boats, but vessels, but 100 foot of anchor chain is a lot of anchor chain, because you probably need 1,000 foot to put it out in 100 foot in order to be able to position the boat. Most of those larger boats that are offshore have dynamic positioning systems, and so there's no anchor at all. They use engines around the vessel in order to keep it in position, very similar to how we do drill ships. So I don't know what the cause of it is, but I do know this. The reported number, actually, I'm impressed with how fast they caught it, because right. The volume of it was about 126,000 gallons, but nobody in our industry thinks in gallons. It's 42 gallons to a barrel, so it ends up being about 3,000 barrels. There's about 5.61 cubic feet per barrel, so you're looking at 16,840 cubic feet was spilled. That's roughly the size of a single mobile home, right? So if you had one that was 18 by, right. by 13 and a half by 80 foot long. So the spill is the size of a two bedroom condo in Huntington Beach would be the volume that was spilled. And given the volume of water offshore, that is just insignificant. Oil and gas are the second most abundant fluid in the Earth's crust. And so it biodegrades extremely well. It will disappear. It's a story today. In right. 6 weeks' time, I don't think it'll be on the headlines. I mean, the Macondo incident would have been 921 mobile homes of oil. And this is a single mobile home. And you're actually using probably 4,300 or 4,400 mobile homes worth of water, or maybe 16,000, depending on what you want to do it, just to make wine in California. So that your use of water and the presence
and that's
of
just
fires
for the
and
Johnson
things,
household,
and that's without irrigation. You know, so I mean, you produce 635 million gallons. That's about 15 million barrels of wine in 2020. It's about 4 gallons of water for every gallon of wine to produce it. So you're looking at, you know, 16,000 mobile homes full of water. And so it's, you know, which one has the bigger environmental impact? One mobile home full of oil or right. 16,000 mobile homes of water when you've got a water situation? The big thing is I don't like using adjectives, so I'm not going to say it was massive. And you can't minimize it. our industry takes this super seriously. Our license to operate depends on us not spilling, reacting rapidly to spills, and mitigating those, because we want to do no environmental damage. We want to be able to provide energy affordably without any environmental risk. And so, or minimum environmental risk. So I don't know the company or the CEO, but I can assure you for our industry, he's under a lot of pressure from his own board and his own employees to get that fixed, understand what happened, and to prevent it happening in the future.
I'm I'll throw some adjectives out there. I think he's handling it well, and I'm kind of impressed by the guy. And I feel bad for the guy, obviously. From what I understand, they actually reworked that pipe to make it more secure by repiping it inside of the pipe, knowing that they probably couldn't get the clearances to do a new pipeline there. So in any case, I'm sure we're going to learn a lot more about this one over time. But it does. So the reason I bring it up when we're talking to you and Flotek is that Flotek does seem to be really focused on ESG, on environmental goals that go beyond what is the standard in the oil and gas industry.
We do. And we work with customers that are also committed to that as well. In fact, that's the niche we're moving into, is to work with people that are serious about measuring the greenhouse gas component of their production and driving that down to zero. That would be the goal. And so how do you help them do that? How do you help them produce it without using carcinogenic chemicals like BTEX, benzene, toluene, xylene? I think everything about us is saying we want to be the environmental chemistry company of choice. And most of our customers, not all, okay, but most of them are committed to that goal as well.
And when I listen to the CEOs and the CFOs on the conference calls every quarter, companies like Devon, they've been kind enough to be on our show as well, CEO of Rick Moncrief, the CEO of Devon. I listen to the calls from Chevron. They are very forthright about changing the way their business is right now and continuing to change it to being more concerned about being a better stewards of the environment. I couldn't have imagined hearing words like I hear now from across the oil and gas industry, even 10 years ago. I mean, I go to an Intercom conference in Denver, and there would be sneers about the notion of a conference that I love. There would be sneers about the very notion of climate change, even. And that just doesn't seem to happen at all, at least, you know, in polite company.
I said this a little earlier. I'll repeat it too, though. It's I really do admire guys like Toby Rice at EQT and Chevron, Devon, Camino. I mean, they're really serious about the environment. And those companies are working hard to get that through their companies. We still are challenged, though, by the fact that the C-suite understands the importance of this to maintain our social license to operate for the future. And we need to get that down to the wellhead so that we don't have a mixed message where their compensation is based on production only. It needs to be on sustainable production. And I think we're still in that transition as an industry where what we're hearing from the C-suite, really good. What we're hearing at the wellhead is still not completely aligned to the scorecard out of the C-suite.
So what does that mean for the sales of what's happening with Flotek right now?
That means it's a bit of a challenge, but we're seeing the change. I mean, I think there's a phase shift where I would have said with oil prices going up and the move towards green that we should be doing significantly better. But the actual buying of green means a change of suppliers, changing contracts, changes of approach. And we're still experiencing that delay. Now, are we getting the meetings on the phone every day with C-suites now, talking about how to change their performance and their sustainability? Those calls are picking up. I'm confident in our vision and our mission. Just need a long enough runway to make it happen.
So do you have that runway? I mean, I mentioned the collapse. I'm not going to put a lipstick on it. It's the stock price has collapsed. And, you know, it's down 60% probably in the last year. I wonder maybe more, you know, do you have the runway that you need?
Well, we have several opportunities to raise cash, and we're working on those, Corey. So I have some assets. We had some properties that didn't have great value because the market was extremely down during COVID. But since then, we've gotten long-term leases at good rates and are marketing that real estate. And I think that's going to give us additional cash. And I think there are a few people interested in, you know, becoming investors in the company that we're talking to going forward. They see what the green positioning is going to do and how the industry is shifting. But I mean, we still have to execute. I mean, our problem now is sales. It's not vision. It's not products. It's not, we really have no other issue than ramping up sales volumes. That's it.
Sales is non-dilutive. It's a good thing to
need sales.
I can tell you.
Yeah. And to do that, actually, I'm pretty excited. We, during COVID, it was hard to figure out when to invest in the sales force, Corey. So it's only been in the last 4 months that I've had confidence oil prices were going to be strong and that the marketplace was going to be strong. And so we've went from very small sales force to a fairly sizable sales force here in the last quarter. And I think that's going to be probably the biggest driver in seeing our sales go up, our number of feet on the street, what you're expecting on a per salesperson in terms of quotas. All of that actually matches the performance that we want to yield for shareholders. But I was probably a little slow in ramping up that additional cost in a down market, being conservative when you don't know when we'll turn around from COVID.
How much you can tell me how many bodies or what percentage of change in sales force is it?
Well, we had a couple that were non-performers we let go. And then we've at least doubled the sales force, both in the chemistry side and in the digital side.
Interesting. Let's talk about the digital business real quick. What the digital business is, the analysis of what's happening in any given pipeline at any given moment, right?
It's the analysis of fluids while flowing without releasing anything to the atmosphere. So we believe in in-pipe measurements, not external. So by the time you have a leak, you know, that's a crazy time to monitor for leaks. You'd rather monitor for no leaks. So we have in-pipe analysis where every 15 seconds, we can tell you the composition of the product you produce from a wellhead, or the product in a pipeline, or the product at a refinery. And so we would know the moment it came out of the ground, how many barrels of diesel, how many barrels of gasoline, jet fuel, you'd be able to refine from that barrel. And we're able to fingerprint oil too and associate it with a particular production operation so that those people that are improving their sustainability, reducing CO2, we're hoping they'll get a premium for that crude in the marketplace and that we'll be able to identify that crude for them going forward so that you know, when they take it to market, you'll see low CO2 crude bring a premium.
Interesting. Let me also ask about net operating loss. This is more of a balance sheet issue. You guys, because you have the great fortune of having lost so much money, that there's an inherent value in the company. What's there and how does that work?
Well, still have over $100 million and have been building those since we last talked, NOLs. The regulations on NOLs are not as lucrative as they were in the past. And so you really have to think about the structure of any acquisition or merger or that you might contemplate to retain advantage of an NOL. But we've spent a lot of time analyzing them to make sure that we can retain and preserve the majority of them. And are looking at opportunities that would give us a chance to take advantage of them.
It's intriguing because you know you're the value the market is valuing the company at $90 million right now. If you've got $100 million of net operating losses, I can see why you would be a buyer personally because you recognize the asset is the you could shut the doors right now and the value of the company would be greater than what you're doing.
And we've still got over $20 million in cash. So, I mean, the cash and the NOLs are greater than the value of the company at the moment. I think you always want a CEO that's a buyer. The moment that I cease to believe in the company, I should resign. I don't have any intention of resigning. And so I continue to buy and I continue to be our biggest advocate as to what we're doing and how we're going to turn this around.
Well, it's an absolutely interesting company to follow. And we haven't had many return guests on the show, so I'm really glad to have you back because it is, like I said, such a great story. And you're good company, John Gibson. We appreciate it. Wish you a lot of luck.
You know, I really appreciate it too, Corey. I mean, it's I like turning things around. Sometimes takes a little longer than others, but I think we're on track, and we just need to stay the course.
All right, when the drill down continues, We're going to talk a little bit more about John Gibson's company, Flowtech, with one number that tells us a whole lot right after this.
The Drill Down is brought to you by Era, a one-stop equity platform where you can seamlessly connect to any earnings call and surface actionable insights automatically. Era's AI-powered tools will allow you to work faster and smarter. That's Era, AIERA.com.
And you can listen to the Drill Down podcast on your favorite speaker, perhaps, if you've got a Google Play or an Amazon Alexa. Just ask that device to play the Drill Down podcast. Hear our latest show.
And let us know what companies you think we should be drilling down on. Talk to us on Twitter and Instagram by following at Drill Down Pod, and connect with us directly at our website, bizpod.net.
Okay, we're back with the Drill Down Bite, that one number that tells us a whole lot about Flowtech. We mentioned the sorry state of affairs with the stock price and the valuation of this company below $90 million now, surely the smallest company we've ever talked about in this show. Isaac, probably the smallest company we ever will talk about. We thought it was worth revisiting. But yeah. That said, yes, there are over $100 million in net operating losses. And yes, there's another $20 million in cash on the books. There's also 164 patent assets at the firm. So there's your number, 164. There are 164 patent assets at this company. So they've got patents, they've got cash, they've got unfortunately increasing net operating losses. It's an interesting company. You know, sometimes you see companies like that bought out just for what's on the books, let alone what might be a promising technology. Well, either way, we love talking to John Gibson. What a great voice. What a nice guy. And what an interesting challenge before him.
100%.
That's a different number.
Yeah.
All right. You've been listening to Drill Down Podcast, and I'm so grateful for that. I'm Corey Johnson. Isaac Webster is our executive producer. Our editor extraordinaire is Ben Wilson. That dog you hear is Nikki. The Drill Down's a production of the Business Podcast Network.